Hello and welcome to the Pint and Click podcast. I'm Dave. I'm here with Jamie and Tony. And today we're going to talk about movies. It is Oscar season. We just watched the Oscars and we watched several Best Picture nominated films. And we're here to talk about each of them individually. And then we'll have a group discussion about La La Land at the end, which we all saw. So I'll start us off. I saw Hell or High Water, which is directed by David Mackenzie. It stars Chris Pine, Ben Foster, and Jeff Bridges. It was nominated for 4 Oscars, but it did not win any, which I feel is too bad because I really enjoyed this movie. It was kind of short and to the point, and it was absolutely beautiful. The framing of each shot and the colors in each shot. It's set in West Texas, so it's a very rural location shoot, which I love. I love, like, True Detective Season 1. Mm-hmm. It's kind of in that same style where it's a lot of empty land and bleakness, and you drive through a town which is just a crossroads, and half the buildings are closed. So the story is Chris Pine and Ben Foster are brothers who have decided to take on bank robbing, and they rob several banks, which gets noticed by the Texas Rangers, and our Texas Ranger Jeff Bridges is intent on hunting them down. Mm-hmm. It's a very modern story. It is set in modern times, even though Jeff Bridges dresses like a cowboy. It's a lot about, you know, hardship in America, and as they're driving down the road, they always have shots of these billboards about debt relief and, you know, reverse mortgages and things like that. The story actually goes, the family farm is under a reverse mortgage, and the bank is going to collect on it now that their mother has died. Chris Pine and Ben Foster's mother has died. And they want to keep the farm because they've discovered oil on the land. So Texas Midland Bank is the bank that owns the reverse mortgage. And so the two brothers decide, hey, let's rob a bunch of branches of Texas Midland Bank, steal the money, use the money to pay back the very loan that they gave our mother, and we get to keep the property. Okay. So they go from town to town. They've never done so the older brother has been to prison. He's got a rap sheet a mile long, as they say. The younger brother, Chris Pine, has never done anything like this before, but he's kind of the mastermind. This is all his plan. But neither of them have committed armed robbery of a bank before, so it's a little comedic in the beginning, in the very first robbery. They don't quite know what they're doing. As the movie goes on, things get away from the plan a little bit, and then things start to go wrong a little bit. And then they get further away from the plan, and they get further and further awry. And Jeff Bridges gets closer and closer. It's a great snapshot of West Texas living, where everyone's got a gun. The people in the bank have guns, the people outside have guns, and the police aren't always the first to respond in these rural towns. So there's a little bit of social commentary with gun ownership and the desperation of the people under these economic hardships. Like I say, it's a beautiful movie. I could watch it again right now just with the sound off, just to watch 90 minutes of the frames on screen. I think they're fantastic. And there's like a couple scenes in a casino with the bright lights. And I don't know how they filmed some of these like scenes at the bar when, you know, they're talking back and forth and the lights are flashing across their face and all of this. It was powerful. It was very attractive to watch this movie. I watched it first thing in the morning and it pulled me up out of my seat. So I'm kind of, I feel bad that it was nominated for 4 Oscars, but it didn't win. I kind of had hope that it would win cinematography or something like that, because that's really where I felt it shined. The script also was excellent, because these are, there's an economy of vocabulary here. People are real careful with their words. They don't say too much. You know, they say a sentence and they kind of leave off the first couple words and the last couple words. They just say the important part in the middle. So it's kind of fascinating to be dropped in the middle of this relationship between these two brothers and the middle of the relationship between Jeff Bridges and his partner. And they've all got shorthand communicating between them. And you as the viewer are trying to pick up on the cues rather than just hearing the dialogue and understanding it. You got to make some assumptions about these guys as they speak, because you don't quite understand. It's not entirely clear what they're saying sometimes. So I love the script. I love the cinematography. I love Ben Foster. He kind of stole the show. He's the older brother and I guess the less famous of the three. Chris Pine is, of course, Captain Kirk from the Star Trek movies, and Jeff Bridges, everyone knows and loves. I definitely recommend it, even though it did not win an Oscar. If you're still looking for Oscar movies to watch, I recommend Hell or High Water.
My first question is, you mentioned that it's light in tone maybe when they're first starting out, robbing places, but does it kind of keep that, since that cast is really charismatic? Would you say that there's some charm to the movie, or is it more like a tonal kind of movie where you're following the feelings of these guys as they're going through it, and as the pressure kind of mounts, you're with them and it's mounting? I mean,
a little bit of both. There's definitely some charm to the movie, even as things get intense and things get more dangerous and more violent. Like, there's still charming moments here and there.
Cool.
But it's definitely where the last whole third of the movie was where, you know, the pressure's getting greater and greater, the danger for the two brothers and for the law enforcement, in fact, is getting greater and greater. So you start to worry about the characters more and more. But, you know, they've got this shorthand speech that makes you feel like you're friends with all of them.
Nice. Okay.
What other movies would you compare it to? Like, who would you recommend this movie to?
So it's kind of like a Western, I would say, because it's a lawman hunting outlaws on its face. It's certainly not set in that time period. It is set in modern day. That's made very clear. But it's West Texas. It's cowboy hats. It's two men going from town to town robbing banks. So I think if you're a Western fan and you're looking for something, if you're okay with it being half modern and not specifically set in that time period, then I think it's a great movie to watch. It comes on slow. It's very casual. It's not, you know, loud explosions and action-packed. So if you like your movies, you know, still with action, but not so much like the Marvel comic book movies with the action scene every eight pages or whatever it is, it's certainly not as loud and fraught with action. There's a lot of low moments where you can relax and just listen to the characters and look at the scenery. It's not really a comedy. It's more of a drama. I would certainly say that. It's there are some action sequences, but I wouldn't call it an action movie. I think modern Western is probably the best way to characterize it.
Sounds really interesting.
Yeah, so that's Hell or High Water. Like I said, it was nominated for four Oscars. It did not win any, which I feel is too bad, but I recommend you check it out. It should be available soon on DVD. This was released much earlier in 2016. So if you're looking to check it out, it should be available soon. All right, so then let's move on to Tony. Tony, what did you watch?
Yeah, I watched The Arrival. It was starring Amy Adams and Jeremy Renner and Forrest Whitaker. Nominated for several awards, including Best Picture, Best Director, but it only won Best Sound Editing, which, getting into that, it's a film about alien contact and about language. You know, you would hope that it has a strong suit in the sound editing, and actually the sound editing was superb.
Was that the guy who has been nominated like 23 or 22 times, and finally this time he won the sound editing?
Oh, it may have been. I don't remember. Okay. Yeah.
And the other director of this particular film also is, I really liked Sicario. I found out about that movie. I think it was also perhaps a nomination from last year. Denis Villeneuve or Villeneuve. Let me just introduce the story first, or the concept, because it's like all of a sudden the world realizes that in 12 different locations throughout the planet, there's a large object, almost like a monolith, that's floating in space above 12 different countries. It is at the point of just complete mysteriousness, whereas, like, you know, all of the world's societies try to get team up and figure out how to best communicate or best to deal with it. And obviously, like, every contingency is in place. They kind of say in the news, and it's everywhere in the news, and they don't really tell you exactly what the contingencies are. We're just seeing it from the perspective of the U.S. and the science teams involved. Amy Adams' character, Louise Banks, is recruited as a linguist to decipher and to get close enough to the alien's ship or whatever it is to bridge a gap between, you know, humanity. And, of course, there's similar scientists working in these other 11 parts of the world. But very interestingly, the tension in this film builds in a kind of slow, progressive way where you are really thrust into the heart of this monolith quite quickly. And I feel like very little time is wasted in order to get our main character and the co-star, Jeremy Renner, a character named Ian, who is a physicist, to get both of them in front of the alien, you know, talking, essentially. But, well, what is the language? It's just sound is weird, you know, wavelengths. And I'll try not to give too much spoilers, but it kind of, it turns into even more of like a, I think anytime you look up a picture or look up Arrival, you see kind of human written on a board. And it, sharing that written language with these aliens' written language kind of is like a back and forth. And of course, the alien language is like infinitely more complex and has to be analyzed by a physicist. And uncovering the mystery is the main conflict of the story. So it's very much a thought-provoking sci-fi rather than any kind of action or any kind of even military pressure that you would imagine would be in this situation doesn't appear until much further into the film. Mm-hmm. So I really appreciated that about this, and that it's a sci-fi that devotes all of its really resources, all the screen time, to kind of establishing a tone, but also helping you as the viewer kind of develop your own theories about what this might be. So it uses things like narrative flashbacks and actually sound editing and clipping where you actually hear things that are not in the scene that you're in, and you're trying to interpret it, what that might mean, as if it were a message sent from the lead linguist Luis's subconscious, or is it sent from the alien, or what? So it had a really satisfying payoff. I mean, without being too, it didn't stick too much to the tropes of sci-fi where like everything is ruined by humanity's needing to fight kind of thing, or nations needing to be independent. But that is, of course, a conflict within here, because what would a sci-fi be without, you know, humans being, you know, imperfect?
Sure.
But yeah, no, I would say it's definitely a slower film, but it had me really kind of at the edge of my seat and really leaned in, even though I was, you know, just watching it on Sunday afternoon, and it was really just took up my whole attention. So I think it did a really good job. It was deserving of all the nominations, at least. So
you say it has a good payoff, and I'm glad to hear that, because I was worried about that with this movie especially. You know, Independence Day has a strong payoff. There's a big explosion at the end. But I didn't know if this much more careful and cerebral movie would have such a good payoff. So I'm glad to hear that. I'm not going to ask you what it is, because we want people at home to watch on their own and enjoy it if they're interested in the movie. But I'm interested in, is it that cerebral a movie? Is there a lot of technological language going on?
I would say that it kind of spares the viewer a little bit in that regard. I mean, it's a scientist and a linguist kind of working together, but I feel like the concepts in and of themselves are easy enough to grasp. Like, they're going to spell it out for you on the screen.
Good.
So it's not like you need to know any kind of science or any kind of math to appreciate some of the things. I mean, there were some terms like the palindrome and writing a language. One of the cool illustrations was their language is kind of through these circles. They describe it as writing with your left hand and right hand at the same time to come up with two separate complementary meanings or something like that.
So giving concrete analogies and stuff to make people understand. Do you think it would be appealing for people who wouldn't traditionally be into the space or alien area of sci-fi? Or is this still, no matter its cerebral or, you know, the more psychological depth of it, would it still be mostly for you have to like sci-fi to like it?
I think you do kind of have to like sci-fi for this. In this particular case, it's not a very Hollywood movie because even the sets are very sparse. I mean, it's a military base in a field. And some of the more interesting sets, I think, are just like ones where soldiers are calling their family and there's just like, it's just stark wood frames and tent structures. I just found it interesting because I thought it was very bland, but it was very true to life. And there were a lot of things about the film I thought, oh, this is probably very true to life. I don't really know from experience, but I could say that, like, you know, you're not going to be having modern luxuries when you're on base. Some of the cool things were that the screen and the set was dedicated highly around the scientists, and it seemed like they had a lot of liberties to to get what they needed, but it wasn't anything like Independence Day where they were in a giant complex or anything like that. It was, they were on site and they were camping and doing science. So it was really cool. But I find that cool just because it's, you know, I think, you do kind of have to be a sci-fi fan or at least, you know, into aliens or into space or theory or even language. So
that sounds great. I'm excited to see that one. That's Arrival. And,
and
I think
it's out on DVD.
That's out on DVD now. So you can pick it up at the library if you like, or place a hold at least. All right. Well, thank you, Tony. And we'll move on to Jamie. Jamie, what did you see?
I'll be talking about the movie Hidden Figures, which is based on a book that came out a couple years ago by Margot Lee Shetterly, which is a true story. And the book was about these human computers, these black women human computers who worked at NASA during the late 1950s, early 1960s. And their story is not really known about now, or it wasn't until the book and the movie came out. But the lives were so fascinating that it was optioned for a movie pretty quickly after the book was published. So it centers on the story of these three women, Katherine Johnson, Dorothy Vaughan, and Mary Jackson, and their work at NASA in 1961-1962. And they served as these human computers, which usually we think of computer as a noun, but they were the verb computers. They were actually computing. So they were these mathematical geniuses. The main character, Katherine Johnson, graduated from high school at the age of 14. Mm-hmm. She was brilliant. She was tapped for all these scholarships and things like that. So they managed to work their way into a computer pool of women that were called the computers at NASA. And their job was to fact check the mathematical calculations that people on the NASA teams were doing. So all the different calculations that they were doing for different trajectories had to be checked and verified by these women. So while it focuses on them, and, you know, when we think about NASA, we usually think of, like, a white man. You know, we think of John Glenn. We think of all these other astronauts. And we don't think of all these women who were working behind the scenes. So the story really focuses on them and the different prejudices and racism that they had to face during that time. And the movie features Taraji P. Henson and Octavia Spencer and Janelle Monáe as the three women. And I thought they did a really good job being these characters. But when I saw the movie, I was still surprised that it had been nominated for Best Picture, because it is, I loved the movie and it is very feel good, but it wasn't what I would think of as Oscar bait. I think because it's a more simple story and it is relatively conflict free. All the racism that they face gets fixed pretty immediately in the film, which is the part that seemed to me like, like, it's a movie, and I understand that they have to compress the timeline into just a couple years for the sake of the film. And, you know, these changes were actually made over a series of decades while they were at NASA. But still, different things would happen. Like, the director of NASA would figure out that, oh, one of these computers, she has to walk 40 minutes away to go to the bathroom because there's no colored bathroom in that area. So she's missing so much time. And then as soon as he finds that out, he goes and he knocks over the sign for the colored bathroom. And he says, you know, we all use the same bathrooms here. So as soon as a conflict arose, it was next scene, it was kind of cut out. So that, to me, kind of diminished the punch of the movie, especially when racism was huge back then in NASA and, you know, everywhere as it is now. And to have it be these tiny things that were just immediately finished kind of diminished the reality of the situation at that time, I think. Even if these individual events did happen, the fact that all of them were smushed so close together made it a lot less potent, I think. And kind of feel good, and maybe we're feeling too good about our past, and maybe we shouldn't be feeling that good about it. But overall, I think it's a really interesting story about something I'd never known before, and I would recommend it. And it was a crowd pleaser. I think it's like 92% on Rotten Tomatoes or something like that. So it is very generally, like, people enjoy it. It's PG, so it'd be definitely like a family film to go see. But I was surprised that it was an Oscar contender. But overall, I really enjoyed it. It was good to see so many different African-American actors and actresses on the stage there. And I think that if it hadn't been an Oscar nominee, I would have gone in with, like, very different expectations. When I went in and it was just so mild, I was surprised, I think.
You said that all the kind of conflicts and moments where you felt a little uncomfortable were, you know, stilted. But what was their kind of a main goal or a main, like, force or plot bringing them? Because, I mean, obviously they were developing calculations and working towards some projects or something.
So it kind of just tracked their progression in different areas. They're trying to be different than IBM, as they knew, like, the real computers were going to come, and trying to stay ahead of that. One was trying to become an engineer, and there had never been, you know, a black woman engineer in NASA before. One was trying really hard to work on the John Glenn project. And it was about them trying to rise up in a institution that was fundamentally structured against them. But there wasn't, like, a one big project they were all trying to work together to finish. It was mostly about their how they kind of moved up and vanquished the different things that they had that their were against them.
Their own individual
kind of. Yeah, their own individual things within the institution of NASA. It didn't seem all over the place or anything like that. It very much seemed like, oh, all of this is cohesive. And it was interesting to see how the astronauts were portrayed, how John Glenn was portrayed. Mm-hmm. He was seen as being very nice to them. He was the only one who would shake their hands, you know, when the line of astronauts was coming down. And so it had a lot of really nice moments. And I think most of it was nice moments, which is, you know, good in this climate. It's nice to have a movie like that. Mm-hmm. But it's also something that's a little different, I think, than what we're used to for Oscar type of movies.
True. And science is back again at the Oscars. I feel like with the whole, you know, we talked about The Martian and Interstellar and all those a year ago, you know, so.
Yeah. And I think it was also interesting to see how they portrayed math on the screen, since a lot of the scenes are Katherine Johnson doing these huge equations on a big chalkboard.
Sure.
And how they try to make this understandable, or not understandable, because I don't think that math was integral in the way that we were supposed to understand it. It was just kind of examples. All we had to understand was that she was better than everyone else. Like, she was correcting all these white men's mistakes. Like, she was really smart.
Sure.
So it didn't really need us to understand the concepts at all. But there were a lot of shots of all these different formulas and stuff. But I think it is hard to, like, how do you actively make math interesting in a movie when it's only supposed to be the numbers, where the theory behind the numbers is not central to the plot.
Sure. All right. So that's Hidden Figures. Again, nominated for 3 Oscars, but didn't win any. No. That's too bad. Mm-hmm. All right, so we'll move on now to our group discussion on La La Land. We all saw that, I think, fairly recently. La La Land was kind of the story of the night. It did not win Best Picture, but it won 6 Oscars and set the record for most, tied for most nominations in history or something like that. So what did we think of La La Land?
I enjoyed it as like a fluffy type of like escapist movie. I enjoyed watching it. It was visually interesting to me, but it could not hold a candle up to like the Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers type of dancing and singing musicals, like the heyday type of musicals. So every time I was watching it, I was like, oh, I'm glad that they're bringing all these things back, but it just made me more nostalgic because it was so much less, especially in the dancing part, which I'll talk about later. So that was my general impression.
Yeah, I liked it as a kind of like romantic love story with song and dance in a cool setting. And I did like the sets, and I liked the quirky and different LA that they like to portray in this musical kind of medium. So I can't say I didn't like it. I thought it was an awesome movie, and if I find myself watching a musical, I usually like it, but I guess it depends. I don't know exactly that I agree with all of the nominations, and that I didn't like. Someone told me before I saw it, which is horrible because I kind of came in with a prejudging it. But they said that they heard that parts that aren't the singing weren't really the strong suit, like the acting and everything else wasn't necessarily. And it's kind of true of that movie. I felt like it was a little choppy and stilted in the dialogue. But the story was, I thought the story was really cool, and the philosophies of being an artist, being in love were really cool. I thought it was a really kind of unique and original story too. So it kind of caught me off guard in some of the actual outcomes.
Yeah, I think cute is the word for this movie. I think it's, you know, Ryan Gosling is cute. Emma Stone is cute.
The colors are cute.
Everything is, it excels in a couple of places where, you know, the color design and the set design is beautiful in pretty much throughout the movie, but in a couple of key places, like the restaurants and things like that, it must have been a real task to set up the lighting, not only to light the set in a conventional way, but then they would do things where like the camera sweeps around and a spotlight comes up. And so being able to do all that in a confined space with a camera and the lighting switching them like that, I have no idea how they did some of these effects or some of these lighting effects, but they were very well done. I thought the music was great. I got into it pretty quick. I left the movie whistling the main theme and
City of Stars.
Yeah, I really
liked that song.
But I don't know. I think it was slow in parts. I thought it was a little bit predictable in parts. I thought it was kind of like Annie Hall, but without the chemistry between the characters. I don't know. Like, I kind of don't have that nostalgia for the old. I do like musicals, but I don't have the nostalgia for song and dance so much of, you know, the heyday of Hollywood. But, you know, I still enjoyed this. When I was worried that I wouldn't, because I like singing, I don't like dancing. I don't know in my movies. I like musicals, but when it's a dance number, it turns me off for whatever reason. But this one was all right.
Mm-hmm. I had kind of the opposite feeling because I love dancing in movies and musicals. So like West Side Story, like ones like that where the dancing is top. I love it. But here, when I was watching them try to spin around, I was like, why even have this in here? If it's, I wanted it to be all like dark so you couldn't see the faces and then they can just throw in real dancers in there.
Stunt dancers.
Yeah. I was trying to think of how elevated it would have been if they used Broadway stars who could like sing versus going for the star power of Emma Stone and Ryan Gosling. But the singing never... To me, it was not anything that I would ever be like, oh, this is ruining the movie. You know, like, I thought they did a good job in it. And I liked Emma Stone in it much more than Ryan Gosling. I thought she did a really good job.
I think her Best Actress Oscar was deserved.
Definitely.
So, I walked out of the theater thinking that because they were both nominated, each for Best Actor and Best Actress. And I'm like, man, I kind of hope that she wins.
Yeah.
God bless Ryan Gosling. I love him in Only God Forgives and Drive and things like that. But
this wasn't the best place for him to showcase his talents because his character wasn't as developed as hers.
He likes jazz and that's about it. And I mean, he likes jazz a lot, but it's true. But when they have the fight 2/3 of the way through the movie and he's like, well, I thought this is what you wanted. And I'm like, I didn't think he had a leg to stand on in this argument. Because her feelings about him were strongly developed, but I don't think his feelings about her were strongly developed.
Right. No.
So that was kind of strange in the way that the relationship, I don't know. I think it sails a lot on their, they have great facial expressions. And so, like, one will say something and the other will smile and you'll feel like, oh, this is a relationship.
Yeah.
This is, you know, they really like each other. But I think they're kind of tricking you with what good actors they are in their faces and their body language. Yeah. But when you look at the story, it's like, I don't really know why he likes her.
Right.
I agree. The part that made me be like, I really like this is at the beginning when she sees him at the party and he's... in that cover band, and she's dancing to and mouthing the words to Iran towards it. And that was when I was like, yes, like, I see it coming together. But then when you look at the dialogue, it's flatter, but you're right what you were saying about the expressions, like, filling in the gaps there a little.
Yeah, and I feel like, just to also riff on what you said earlier, just that through the nonverbals and through the even that dance scene where there was so little said, that was really their key turning point in their relationship, which is kind of ironic when you think about it. I mean, it's cool that they use the medium of dance to do it, to show, hey, this is a thing they're developing as a partnership. I just thought it was like, yeah, they're using an old style to tell a new tale, and it's probably lost on a lot of viewers anyway. So it's, I don't know. I thought it was really cool just because I wasn't necessarily expecting that, even though it's on the cover or whatever. Yeah. But
it might be gesturing to all these tropes that most 21st century viewers aren't aware of, you know?
Yeah,
I agree. And I think always in movie musicals, switching back and forth from a song to a regular scene can be stilted a lot of the time.
Sure. Whereas
a lot of times, like, the songs don't really have relevance in the scene, but I think they need to be really good to pull it off. And here I think you're right that maybe the songs were trying to stand in for too much or asking too much of the
Tony had said earlier, like, the song and the dance, the musical numbers are kind of the focus of the movie, and the scenes in between kind of fall flat. I think there's a few that are okay, but yeah, there's kind of a lot that, like, I'm not really remembering. As I think back to the movie, it's the musical numbers that I remember, and the musical numbers that had an emotional connection and development to the characters.
What did we think of the ending?
I loved it.
That was what redeemed it, I think, for me.
Yep. I don't want to give it away because I kind of... saw this relationship building and I kind of knew the way things were going and I'm like, how's this movie going to end? Because, you know, it could be very satisfying. It could be very disappointing. I wasn't sure. And it turned out to be very satisfying, I feel.
I agree. Because I think with a movie that is over the top intentionally in so many ways, that ending kind of grounded it a little bit and brought us back to the reality of things. So,
Yeah, far and away my favorite part of the movie was the ending.
Yeah. Which I think is good. You know, that's what we want when we walk away.
You want a big finish. You want a satisfying ending. Absolutely.
Yeah.
But otherwise, I don't know. My wife walked out and said, that was a great movie. I never want to see it again. That's kind of how I feel about it, too. Like, I've had my La La Land experience, and I don't need any more than that.
Yeah, and I also feel like that is not necessarily a soundtrack I would listen to in my car.
I was thinking about that, too, compared to, like, Book of Mormon. And,
exactly, you know, or Hamilton, or things like that
that I've been listening to over the past many years. This is not one that I'm going to search out on Spotify.
Yeah, no. Whenever I watch a musical, I'm always thinking, like, would kids in community theater do an audition song with this song? Since that's what I did all through high school. I was like, I don't think any of these songs, like, little girls would be like, oh, I'm going to sing this song for my next audition or anything.
No, I don't think so at all. So, that sounds like our opinion on La La Land. Pretty good, I guess. Sums it up.
Deserving of not winning Best Picture.
Deserving of not winning Best Picture, but still not a bad movie. Yep. I recommend it. Go see it.
Yeah, I agree.
Or wait for it to come out at the library.
And I'm hoping that its success at the box office will bring more musicals back.
Yeah, I do too.
That maybe they can blend the different genres better, you know, build on that. So.
Yeah. All right, so that's our discussion of La La Land, and that brings us to some sad news. Jamie, it turns out that you're leaving us.
I am.
Both here and at the library and here on the podcast.
Yes.
So what are you going to be doing?
So today is my last day at the library. I am actually going to be in Japan from March through August on a writing fellowship from the National Endowment of the Arts. So I've been writing a book based on Japanese mythology for several years right now. And I won this fellowship, so now I actually get to go to Japan and do some final research and scouting out the locations to make sure I can get details right and things like that so I don't make a big, like, glaring error.
Sure.
So that's what I'll be doing for 4 months. I'll be traveling around trying to get by on, you know, the 20 words of Japanese that I know. That will hopefully double in the next month. I'm not leaving for a month, so I have a month to try to pack and get my stuff together. So I'm really excited. I'm going to eat all the time and look at everything and go to all different islands and things like that. But I am very sad to leave the library. This is my favorite job I've had, and I'll miss being able to have access to books. So.
Yeah, I imagine. So you will be coming back. So maybe we'll have you on as a guest or
we'll
read
your
book
or
something like that.
Yeah, I would definitely love to come as a guest, whether it's, you know, as the failed writer who tried to write a book or as, you know, with a book, but I would love to. And if any of you want to follow my journey, I will be blogging and it'll be on my website, which is just my name, jamienakamura-lynn.com, which is JAMINAKAMURALIN.com, jamienakamura-lynn.com. And I will be blogging and posting pictures and stuff there. So.
That's great. Well, we'll read your blog and you'll listen to the podcast and we'll stay in touch that way. As for the rest of us, Tony and I aren't going anywhere and we're going to see about getting some new blood in the podcasting room. So more details on that at the next podcast. Jamie, we'll miss you.
I'll be very missed. I'll catch up as a listener now.
But you'll always be a founder of the Pioneer podcast here at the Des Plaines Public Library. All right. Thanks, everyone. We'll see you next time.